from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. This Saturday, NASA and SpaceX, the private aerospace company founded by Elon Musk, are set to launch the first crewed rocket from U.S. soil since 2011. Coming up at 9, Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at Stanford University, Scott Hubbard, will join us to talk about the launch and what the mission means for the future of space exploration. Then at 9:30, Congressman Adam Schiff will join us, and we'll hear about why he thinks Twitter and YouTube need to do more to stop the spread of misinformation about the coronavirus. And we'll get his take on President Trump's plans to issue an executive order today removing liability protections for social media platforms. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. SpaceX is set to launch a rocket for NASA on Saturday. It will be the first time astronauts will be launched into space from U.S. soil since 2011, when the space shuttle was retired. It will also be the first time ever that a privately developed spacecraft will take humans into Earth's orbit. The mission was planned for yesterday, but it was called off 17 minutes before liftoff because of weather conditions. And in this segment, we want to discuss what the mission means for the future of space exploration. And joining us is Scott Hubbard, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University, also former director of NASA Ames Research Center. And Scott, it's been a while, but I'm really glad to have you back with us. Remember back in the day, we had many discussions with you, an astronomer and NASA Ames scientist, David Morrison, which I remember quite vividly. Glad to have you.
Good morning, Michael, and thanks for having me on again. Delighted to be here.
Well, as I say, delighted to have you, and I want to talk about SpaceX with you because it's off for now, 20 minutes or so before the weather was simply too full of electricity in the air and all that sort of thing. But at this point, we're talking about the likelihood, if the weather is okay, of a launch on Saturday or possibly on Sunday. And what I'd like to find out initially is your thoughts about this really being the first, well, the first thing with humans, really, since 2011, as I said in the introduction, with Flight 135. It was almost totally focused on finishing the space station. But at this point, we're talking about, going up with people once again, and yet a very different kind of hybrid operation, because we've got not only NASA involved, we've got private enterprise and Elon Musk.
Absolutely. This is a major milestone in the history of space exploration, and particularly, of course, human space flight. But I truly believe and thought for years this was the right direction to go in. NASA can focus now more on deep space, and you've got these private companies, Boeing is also involved in the commercial crew program, that are using their own designs. And on Saturday, we hope to see two astronauts go to the station on the SpaceX vehicle.
And those two astronauts, we should mention, Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken, pretty highly trained, vetted strongly by NASA. These are a couple of guys who have flown missions before, and, well, they're, from all appearances, really sort of consummate professionals, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I've met both of them, Bob and Doug. Have a long history in space flight. They've both, I think, done at least two shuttle flights before. Highly trained, highly skilled, very bright guys. Just the sort of people you want to do this so-called Demonstration 2 mission.
Talking with Scott Hubbard, and he is professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford, also former director of NASA Ames Research Center. Chris Cassidy is the lone NASA astronaut now at the International Space Station. And we've been a little too dependent on the Russians here, haven't we, Scott? I mean, we're going to be saving a good deal of money as a result of this because the seats and the costs were going up for the Russians.
That's right. The Russians may not have started out knowing a great deal about capitalism, but they learned in a hurry, and the price per seat went up and up. So there are two issues, obviously. One is national security, national prestige. The U.S., NASA needs assured access to space. And then the second thing is the cost. I think the latest purchase was about $90 million for a seat aboard the Soyuz. And a study last year said that this commercial crew program that SpaceX is a part of, it'll be about $50 million. So almost a factor of two difference in price.
What do you see in terms of this or envision vis-a-vis the future of space exploration? What does this mean?
It means a great deal to, in the near term, relieving NASA of the responsibility for the service, the low Earth orbit transport of goods and people up and down to the space station. And so NASA can now devote more of their attention and resources to deep space, be it the pointy end of the spear. But in addition to that, of course, in the person of Elon Musk, you've got a visionary who very much wants to go to Mars. And he's using, as I understand it, the profits from his work for NASA to build something he calls the Starship. And, you know, he's got a ambitious plan to make humanity a multi-planet species.
Well, we could perhaps talk about that in more depth, but I also wanted to get to a little bit of the history of you and Elon Musk here. I think it goes back to when he cashed out on PayPal and you two met, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was about 19 years ago. And one, I had just returned from being the first Mars program director, or Mars czar, as the media called me. And I was at NASA Ames, and one of my advanced programs people called me and said, there's this guy who seems to have a lot of money. He wants to go to Mars, but you know, he needs some people to talk to who really understand all the science and engineering, and he'd like to come and meet you. And I said, sure, fine. What's his name? And he said, he's a South African. His name is Elon Musk. And so in 2001, we had a meeting in my office at NASA Ames, and he explained his vision of sending a mission to land on Mars and scoop up some dirt and grow a rose on Mars and beam it back to the school children of the world so they could see life on another planet. And I said, wow, that's really something, Elon. Let me tell you what's involved. And we had then a series of three or four lunches at a place, one of the first microbreweries down on the peninsula in Menlo Park called the Tide House. And one of the meetings near the end of our discussions, I said, you know, Elon, if you want to change the face of space exploration, give the world an inexpensive, reliable rocket. And next year he founded SpaceX. So that was my early story.
Quite a story, and a seminal one at that. We're talking to Scott Hubbard. We're talking about the space launch, and we do want to hear from you. If you have thoughts, give us a call. If you have questions, give us a call. And you can do that right now. Our toll-free number is available. The number to call is 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, and you can be part of the program. You can also get in touch with us and be part of the program by going to Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. Interested in your thoughts, though. Again, Scott Hubbard is professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford. He's also former director of NASA Ames Research Center. And Scott, what are you thinking about this in light of the pandemic? I mean, there was quarantining going on with flights to Mercury and Gemini and Apollo. They were all quarantined, and certainly quarantined when they came down and touched down. What's been done on that score?
The astronauts that are involved, Bob and Doug, would have gone through the standard quarantine process. If you remember the movie Apollo 13, one of the astronauts didn't get to make the trip because he was showing flu symptoms. So that process of isolating the crew to be sure they're not sick before they go on a flight has been processed for decades. In addition to that, in this most recent flight, particularly for the U.S. astronaut who went up on the Soyuz mission, there was an additional layer of testing and verification that they, in fact, did not have the coronavirus. So NASA's been very aware of that and taken the appropriate steps.
And this will be an orbit to last how long? I mean, there's been some changing and shifting gears and pivoting on that, hasn't there?
Yes, there has. Yeah. Originally, as you can get from the title, the official title of this mission is Demo 2, meaning demonstration of spaceflight with this all-new vehicle. The plan was to have the crew just stay up there very briefly, maybe a week or two. But as things changed, as NASA became aware that they needed to provide or should provide some more testing and demonstrations and so forth, they've extended the mission now to possibly as long as 120 days, as long as 4 months. The actual duration, I think, will be determined by what happens on orbit. But the crew had to undergo some additional training to do this, because you can't just walk into the space station. There are all kinds of processes and procedures you need to know.
Well, they have enough food and oxygen for days, I know. They could do many orbits before they come down, couldn't they?
They could. In an emergency, if for some reason the vehicle didn't dock with the space station, they have plenty of oxygen and water and so forth, and they could make many orbits and then return safely. And of course, once they get to the space station, they've got all of those resources too.
Give us an idea, if you could, about what we can expect to learn from this launch. And I'd like to also find out from you how technologically this spacecraft is different from, say, earlier space shuttles.
Well, there's a number of demonstrations planned. Even though this is a fully autonomous vehicle, and the crew wouldn't necessarily have to do anything to dock with the space station, they want, NASA, SpaceX, both want to demonstrate manual control. If in some case all of the autonomous backups fail, then they would be able to fly in and dock with the space station. There's going to be thorough checkout while they're there of the operations, particularly the power available. The solar panels that are on the Crew Dragon have a limited lifetime. They're going to be monitoring that. And as far as how the vehicle goes, how it's designed, it is a far cry from if you walked into the Smithsonian and looked at the old Mercury, Gemini, Apollo capsules, and you look at this one with a heads-up display and seven seats aligned so you can have that many passengers, all of the controls, the cool spacesuits. If you've noticed how different those are than what they used to call the pumpkin suit, the orange thing that was worn on the shuttle. So it's a brand new state-of-the-art vehicle for the crew.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the launch, which will go on this weekend, likely to go on this weekend, depending on what the weekend weather is like, and also the future of space travel and really what's up ahead, what lies ahead. Scott Hubbard is with us, and you can be with us as well. We do want to hear your thoughts and any questions you might have. You can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. This is only a half-hour segment, so if you have something you'd like to ask or say, now would be the time to call. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And Scott, when you talk about long-range goals here, not just transport, you'd mentioned earlier, Elon Musk really wants to see our species as a multi-planet species, a rather ambitious vision to be sure. But I know you've been talking a lot about planetary protection and needing to decontaminate. There are actually concerns with alien viruses contaminating Earth or hitching a ride onto what may be coming back, pollutants that could hitch back with us from Mars, for example. There's been a lot of speculation coming from you and others about this. Are we doing all kinds of safeguards here in terms of exploring space in the future? Do we do pretty much what we need to do prophylactically?
Absolutely. This is this discipline of planetary protection has been around for over 50 years. The U.S., as is 120 other countries, is a signatory to something called the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. And the essence of it says we won't contaminate other worlds and we won't let other worlds contaminate us. And up to this point, the spacecraft have been, with the exception of Apollo, robotic spacecraft. And you can steam them, you can bake them, you can wipe them down with chemicals, and you can be sure that it's clean when it leaves. And when we get to launching Perseverance in July, the tubes that will contain the samples that will come back will all have been exquisitely cleaned. And then when they are returned to the Earth, they'll be treated extremely carefully until we know that these million-year-old rock samples pose no issue. The reason this came up just now is that in addition to these challenging robotic missions, there are two new initiatives. One, very serious discussion of humans to Mars, and two, commercial players like SpaceX who want to go to Mars, and applying what NASA has learned to those two areas are a part of what this National Academy study was that I participated in and that was just released.
Now, I had said earlier that you and I and David Morrison did many programs in the past together, and the question always comes up similar to along these lines. This is from a listener named Jordan who writes, "In light of all our problems on planet Earth, I'm not convinced humans need or should spend massive funds and resources to establish themselves on another planet." You've given some counterarguments to that in the past. Where do you stand now, and what's the counterargument now?
Well, I think that as human beings, we want to explore. I mean, some fraction of people will always want to know what's over the next hill, and so exploring our solar system is part of that. It's been part of what we've done as a species since the dawn of the space age, and I think that will go on. Scientific exploration to understand if life emerged elsewhere in the solar system or elsewhere in the universe is going to go on. In addition to that, though, since we last talked about it, we now have a very serious demonstration of deep space capability by Elon Musk, by SpaceX. If you recall, it wasn't a few months ago that he launched the Falcon Heavy carrying his cherry red Tesla Roadster to an orbit much like the orbit of Mars, and showing that there are private individuals of their own means, Jeff Bezos is another, who want to explore other worlds and even make us a multi-planet species. So there's an additional group involved here that was not present when you and I talked last.
And here's Tom joining us. Tom, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about the privatization of space. You kind of touched on your meetings with Elon Musk prior. It makes a lot of sense that private companies take much more control of low Earth orbit. You know, for example, Starlink. You know, there's a lot of money there. But how would SpaceX make money traveling to places like Mars? Like, what are the fiscal implications of stuff like that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Tom, Scott, we'll go back to you.
Yes, very good question. A business case, a return on investment, I think by private industry is very clearly demonstrated in things like the OneWeb notion, you know, having a internet for the whole planet or remote sensing observations. That's a pretty solid business case. I don't know of a business case right now for going to Mars unless NASA sees a way to buy a ride there that is at lower cost. This trip to Mars that Elon Musk wants to do right now is in the visionary category. There are other experiments going on to provide payload services to the moon by these private companies. So we'll see how it's developing. Right now, it's a little bit beyond what I would call a solid business case.
And I thank Tom for the call. Bring on another caller. That's you, Sarah. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I generally just had a comment. I'm interested what you guys think of it. I'm concerned about Elon Musk's satellites and the impact they have on our ability to see the night sky? And don't I have a right as a citizen to the natural resource of our gorgeous sky? And what right does he have to irreparably change that for me?
Scott Hubbard.
Yes, that's a very good question. It is something that is being discussed right now by the various regulatory governmental entities, things like the International Telecommunications Union that assigns frequency slots. There are many countries and many entrepreneurial initiatives to put up these hundreds of spacecraft that would provide internet service for the whole planet. But a downside of that is that you have then an enormous number of vehicles up in space that are both a hazard as far as space debris goes, and as you point out, could obscure the night sky. So there are proposals on the table from the regulatory groups to require that these be coded or organized or somehow controlled so that they don't really affect the observing of the astronomers. Nobody's got a good solution yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is an ongoing vexing problem, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, space debris and then the collateral problem of viewing the night sky, which is a newer issue, have been around for a long time.
Let's try to get Wynn on quickly. Wynn, good morning.
Thanks. Now that we're moving to personal travel out into space, can we expect to see gantries growing all over the country, or are they going to find some way to be able to use airports so they could take off as normal airplanes?
Well, that's a wonderful question. One of my other roles at Stanford was working with the FAA and something we call the Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation. And the last time I checked, there were a dozen applications for spaceports. These have to have different capabilities from that of an airport. Some things are very similar, but if you look at Spaceport America out in the desert in New Mexico, it doesn't look like a San Francisco International Airport. So there is a proliferation of these applications in different stages of development. And I don't think all of them will be necessary or will survive as a profitable enterprise. But yes, in the near term, you're going to see a lot of groups from Indiana to Oklahoma to Texas to New Mexico developing spaceports.
Scott, good to have you with us, and good luck on the launch. It's going to be a tight one. I know they have to arrive during the day, and they have to allow for 8 hours of sleep for both of the astronauts, so I hope everything goes well. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks again, Michael. Really enjoyed it.
And we will be back with Congressman Adam Schiff. That's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.